When Rich Kilmer invited me to this conference many months ago now, I said a small prayer of thanks. In January 2006, George Huntzinger asked me to speak at a similar gathering aimed at stopping the use of torture. That conference, as Rich told us yesterday, did lead to important changes to this country's policy of using torture. And I am praying fervently at this moment that this conference will have a similar positive impact. And I'm increasingly confident as the day goes on that that will be the case. But let me be clear, I think our task with regard to targeted killing is even more difficult than with regard to stopping the use of torture. We know that torture had been used in this country from about 2002 on. Pictures were revealed from the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq showing horrible abuse of persons within U.S. custody. By 2009, President Obama had signed an executive order to end the use of torture. The United States also began targeted killing in 2002. Unlike the use of torture, we knew about that targeted killing with a drone attack in Yemen carried out by the CIA launching a Hellfire missile from a drone, and that is really where no one has said the word Hellfire yet. That's the real problem that we should be focused on. In addition, as Jeremy Waldron said last night, the fact that we're killing human beings unlawfully, we're also using a weapon of war, military force, in non-armed conflict situations. It's not the drone, per se, as Gabor Rona said, it is the Hellfire missile. The CIA has no right under international or national law to be carrying out paramilitary operations, operated that drone from the French country of Djibouti, and killed six persons in a car in Yemen where there was no armed conflict going on. So that was not a secret. The Los Angeles Times did two full stories in two different issues of their newspaper reporting on it. The UN Special Rapporteur for Extrajudicial Killing, Asma Jahangir from Pakistan, reported in January 2003 to the United Nations that killing in Yemen was an extrajudicial, unlawful killing. So January 2003, a year or more before we publicly became aware of the use of torture. So why has it been so much harder to end this blatantly, this expert determination that the use of drones outside of armed conflict zones to fire Hellfire missiles is unlawful? As you've heard from a number of the other speakers, part of the problem is that within both international and domestic law, as well as the mainstream teaching of the three principal religions represented here, Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, killing is not an absolute prohibited act as torture is. So we have to make a more sophisticated case to end this form of killing, which is absolutely prohibited. We have to distinguish it from those areas where we can't necessarily bring the law on our side until we get the law completely in support of a more pacific teaching from our major religions. But I think the other reason why it's more difficult is not necessarily even this tangible problem within law and religion, and I hope to speak about both in my very brief time here today. Also, by now, perhaps as a result of the fact that killing is not per se absolutely prohibited, or other reasons, popular culture, not only in the United States, but around the world, has bought into an ethos of militarism that has created a sense where if you say to somebody, and I'm sure many in this room have had this experience, but killing with drones in Yemen or Somalia is unlawful, people say, you've got to be kidding. As Gabor said, there are bad guys in Yemen. We have to kill them or they'll kill us. We kill them there, they kill us. That is considered the wisdom of our time. That's considered good because we're keeping ourselves secure and security is good. Or we're stopping people who would harm others and that's a good. So our everything we do, our entertainment, so many other things are around this idea that military answers, as Bishop Pate said last night, we see we have a giant hammer and we want to make it bigger because we have come to see the world full of nails. So the drone has just added to this. It's the high tech, it's the sleek. It gives the president a very low cost way of buying into and being part of this widespread understanding that this kind of killing is somehow not just wrong, not just for the exceptional situation, but a way of showing how powerful, how exceptional the countries that use drones for killing are. The seductive quality of killing with drones has led international lawyers, ethicists, and even theologians to present arguments in which they find the law and the Bible supporting killing with hellfire missiles launched from drones. And I would just suggest to you that this has been a very short period of time so that I think we can have some hope that we can turn it around. These arguments that we are hearing today from just war ethicists, from international lawyers, would never have been made during the Cold War. So we're talking about a period of time from 1990 until today. It should not be so deeply entrenched that we cannot turn it around with efforts like the ones we're talking about here today. So let me give you just a brief account of what international law actually says and how I understand the authentic just war theory to mutually support the broadest and most robust restrictions on killing as a way, and then maybe at the end I'll just offer an idea of how we can perhaps re-inspire the world to think about those restrictions as the good, the killing as the evil. International law has a very well-known rule at the heart of the United Nations Charter, Article 2, Paragraph 4. It imposes a broad and general prohibition on the use of armed force by states. Unfortunately, I see in my area of expertise the law governing resort to force. It's a distinctive from what you heard from Gabor and Wendy talking more about the law on the battlefield. But the law with regard to resort to force, we find today in journal after journal, in talk after talk, that international lawyers want to find exceptions, increasing exceptions to get around the prohibition. This is the focus. I wrote recently that the American Journal of International Law, one of the leading professional journals in the field of international law, has published 5 articles in the last 6 years, each of which argues for a broader right, a broader interpretation of the UN Charter to allow more killing. Not a single one in response to that view. This is the common thread today. Not only do we not see strict interpretations of the Charter as written that would result in restraints, far greater restraints on the use of force, we have not seen a single move to expand the scope to prevent more armed conflict under the Charter since it was written in 1945. Not a single move, for example, to prohibit under international law resort to military force within a country, namely against civil war. Civil war does not have a specific rule in international law against it. But Article 2.4 could reach even a civil war because it says all use of force is prohibited. It is a broad prohibition that prohibits every kind of significant military force above a de minimis level, above the police force level, for example, where a police vessel might shoot across the bow of a fishing boat that is catching excessive amounts of fish. The Charter itself actually has only 2 express exceptions to this broad and powerful prohibition on the use of military force in international relations. It has a very narrow exception for self-defense. Article 51 of the Charter says that if a sovereign state, is the victim of an armed attack, in that situation, it may defend itself with military force on the territory of the attacking state and may invite others in to assist it until the Security Council acts. The International Court of Justice has further restricted Article 51 self-defense and has pointed out that that armed attack must be a significant armed attack. And it has pointed out that under the rules of state responsibility, you can't just, if a terrorist group launches an attack on your country, you can't attack the state where that group is simply because they're there. That attack has to be the responsibility of that state. So when the United States attacked Anwar al-Awlaki with a Hellfire missile, we had no basis in the law of self-defense, despite what President Obama said, to justify that. There was no attack on the United States from Yemen. The attacks that the United States alleged that Mr. al-Awlaki was planning were somehow in the future. They had never taken place. But even if they did take place, Yemen wasn't responsible for them. And they would not have been significant enough to justify military force. Police action, yes, of the kind that we used to carry out in cooperation with Yemen when al-Qaeda first started attacking in this country and attacked our Navy vessel, the USS Cole, in the harbor of Aden in 2000. We sent the FBI. We could always do that, but not Hellfire missiles, not under Article 51. The other express exception is also quite limited, and that's when the Security Council authorizes the use of force. But the Security Council, even if it is assessing whether it would be lawful under the Charter, it has to determine that the use of force would be a last resort and that it will promote peace and security in the world. International law, as the International Court of Justice has told us, every use of force and really every forceful action, whether it's sanctions or other kinds of coercion, must, prior to their being implemented, be responding to an unlawful action and be necessary to bring it about, to bring about an end to it as a last resort, because other peaceful means do not work, and only cause proportionate harm in the course of reestablishing the legal situation, responding to. This analysis is really only open to the Security Council when it's authorizing force, or to a state that has been attacked by another sovereign state. This law of the Charter does not support what the United States and other countries have been doing with drones. In addition to these specific rules on resort to force, we never forget in any situation that the United States or any country is involved in, that human rights law is always part of the calculus. Nevertheless, despite these narrow and important rules restricting the use of force, as I mentioned to you, there seems to be some kind of favorite occupation among law professors and our students to write articles seeking to expand the right to use force in self-defense, and to even come up with alternatives to the Security Council for self-authorization. Let NATO authorize, or democratic countries can authorize. No, this is not what the law requires. And in 2005, just 10 years ago, the world came together after the 2003 unlawful invasion of Iraq at the invitation of the Secretary General of the UN, completely reviewed the UN Charter principles and the operations of the United Nations in general, and agreed in September in New York of that year to reconfirm the Charter as written and to strictly comply with the principles of the Charter on peace. Now, that was 2005, just 10 years ago. So what I have just stated to you is the law. There was the preliminary report of the panel that the Secretary General asked to review the charter and the operations of the United Nations in general, concluded that the only use of force that can be considered lawful and legitimate in international relations conforms with the charter. This has to be the case, because the UN Charter and international law in general is the common code of humanity. This is what we everywhere have in common. We do not have one religious faith. We do not share one ideology. We do not share one ethical approach to these important questions, but we do share international law. That document, which reinforced this view and reestablished that for all of the world, all sovereign states are committed to the Charter and its rules on peace, did have some language, some commentary, that I'm afraid helped spread the idea of use of force as a good. It was only commentary, but it was around this idea that military force could be good and useful for defending human rights. And that was a very short, I thought we had 20 minutes.
We have 5 minutes. This is my 5 minutes.
All right, I see your 5 minutes. I'm going to go into hyperspeed now. But France and the United Kingdom, by 2011, were pushing for the use of force in Libya. And they, in the United States, joined them using drones there, arguing that they would protect civilians. But even in this case, you see that no negotiation was tried to protect civilians within the Libyan civil war. And the excessive use of force ended up within 4 months that NATO killed 30,000. NATO was part of the killing of 30,000 people in Libya. And a civil war began that has not ended. So military force should be dissociated, the whole idea, with any possibility of good. We have data from the USIP and other scholars showing that intervention, military intervention, either in civil wars or for counterterrorism, do not lead to positive outcomes. And while this data clearly supports the legal and moral case against the use of military force, it is irrelevant to anything but the Security Council's own legal assessment of the success of authorizing intervention, or a state assessing whether it has should go to war when it has actually been attacked and has a right of self-defense. I was going to talk in some detail about how international law on the use of force is commensurate with and tracks the Roman Catholic just war doctrine. In fact, the Catechism sets a bar above the minimum requirements of international law. The injury that a state suffers must be lasting, grave, and certain, and the response must not inflict evils and disorders graver than the evil to be eliminated. Moreover, the Catechism only refers to aggression and defense, not force for these reasons that the Security Council might authorize: human rights, arms control, or counterterrorism. Logically, therefore, an ethical leader in a case of self-defense, or the Security Council as the right authority for all other cases, needs to first consider the law on resort to force, and then if resort would be lawful, whether it also meets moral teaching. In other words, there's a two-level hurdle before resort to force could possibly be acceptable. Yet scholarship advocating resort to force indicates a widespread disrespect for the authentic international law against force, an attitude that, in my view, can be traced to just war scholars who take little or no notice of international law in shaping their assessments of the morality of armed force, and who have in turn been influenced by the realist school of reliance on military force. Today's international legal regime against the use of force, especially the peremptory norm against serious violations of Article 2.4, is not only the law, it is the basis, it is the minimum basis of morality. In other words, for a war to be just, it must at least be lawful. To go to war in violation of the UN Charter is both a legal and a moral wrong. This means that the peace regime of international law presents a set of rules that is not only helpful as a general matter for fulfilling moral obligations, it forms the first step toward fulfilling those obligations when it comes to war. I was going to go on, but I know I'm out of time, to talk about some of the theories of people like Jean Beth Kielstein of the University of Chicago, who talked about moral wars without taking into account international law or getting it wrong. Even Princeton's Michael Walzer, widely respected as an ethicist, and yet he does not take international law seriously into account in his justification of going to war. But by the 1980s, David Hollenbeck, the Jesuit of Boston College, had been trying to and arguing for reversing what some of these ethicists in the area of just war have done. He pointed out that the moral presumption from Aquinas and other of our great moral thinkers presumes that war is sinful, and the presumption is that war should always be a last resort. Hollenbeck wanted to reshift this presumption. Against war, always the last resort. I'm sorry to say that until now he has failed. I'm not sure what it will take to get people to get this presumption right again. I myself have been thinking while I'm here at Princeton about what will end what Pope Francis called the madness of war or the madness of militarism. I don't think looking strictly at the law, and I'm making my final sentence here, looking strictly at the law or even the history or the counterproductivity of military force to solve so many of our problems will help. I do think going back to Aquinas and his support and belief in the role of law in human flourishing will be helpful, but more than that, for what he told us about the transcendentals of what is truly the good, the true, and the beautiful. He said that which is beautiful is true and good, and it has the qualities of clarity, integrity, and proportion. These are the very qualities of good law, like the law against the use of force. In a sense, it would be poetic justice, a beautiful justice, if a return to the concepts of Aquinas, regardless of our religious beliefs or understandings, revived a love of peace and a view that peace is the beautiful.